Welcome back. I'm Richard Dolan, and I'm here with really one of my favorite people in the field of UFOs, a guy I've known for many years now, and not simply an excellent researcher, but really one of the nicest people in the UFO field today. So welcome, Mike Clellan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm one of the nicest people in ufology. Is that okay?
I think you are.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's I'm up against Barbara Lamb in that. So I should.
You're not as nice as Barbara Lamb.
No one is. So
no, but you're definitely nice, and that counts for something.
Good. Thank you.
No, Barbara's in. She is like the ultra nice person, isn't she?
She's like a little. She's like the Hallmark card grandma.
She really is. That's so true.
Her and the late Dolores Cannon. They were both cut from the same cloth, I think.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know Dolores as well. I've met her. She was always very sweet to me, Dolores. And I did like her very much. Very interesting lady. And actually did very similar kind of research in some ways, at least compatible with
Barbara. Yeah, absolutely.
And they, I don't think I'm saying anything out of sorts, but Barbara was a character in the book The Custodians. She went under a pseudonym, and she's been pretty open about that in the years since. One of the people that was hypnotized about their experiences, I think it was driving along a road at night and mistaking the events on the side of the road as, I think, like a fire truck. And it's all explained very mysteriously, like, why is this fire truck here? Why are all these lights on? And then it, once under the hypnotic, in the hypnotic regression, it turns out it wasn't a fire truck at all on the side of the road. And that was Barbara Lamb. Yeah, she's been pretty open about talking about that.
Yeah. Well, actually, this is a good opportunity for me to say, and I don't know if anyone else has said this to you, Mike, but in the amount of intensive research that you have been doing into this field formally, at least for about a decade now, I think, and after having written one of the most interesting books in this field, The Messengers, and you're about to publish your sequel, Stories from the Messengers, my observation is that you in reality are one of the most knowledgeable people of the abduction phenomenon, aside from all of the other weirdness that you write about, synchronicities and owls, but just the UFO abduction phenomenon. There's a lot of other people who have a lot to say about this. There's Whitley Strieber, and there's Barbara Lamb, and there's many others, but I count you as, when I think of all the people that I personally know in this field who have deep insights into this phenomenon, I have to count you on the short list. I don't know if anyone else has said this to you.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, I actually just spent a day and a half with Mary Rodwell. She was here in the States, and I visited
Australia.
Her. She's from Australia, and she was in New Hampshire for a few days. And so I made the effort to, you know, do the fairly long drive and spend some time with her. Yes, I appreciate that greatly. I don't know if that's true or not. There's people who are, you know, have decades more research under their belt.
I realize that, but when I hear you speak about this, and I mean, you and I talk privately and I hear you talking publicly, you always have relevant things to say. You always have something insightful to say about it. And in fact, you know, what's going on in this field among current researchers, as well as just about anyone that I know. So you may be more of an expert than you realize, or than you
well,
might
thank
be
able you for to, saying that. Yeah. I mean, I've been, my life has flipped upside down in the last, you know, 6 years or so, as I've, you know, thrown myself into this research.
Go
ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, many listeners absolutely know a lot about you, but I'm sure there are listeners who don't necessarily know a lot about you or as much as they would like to. And I'm just wondering if you might give a nice overview of your interest in this field, your own particular experience, which you have written about and talked about, your own abduction experience, your own experience with owls and synchronicities, and how you kind of worked your way into this field. If you can do that in a kind of quick little overview, if that's possible.
Okay. Just don't be afraid to crack the whip if I start going on and on here, but, you and I are the same age, Rich. So,
yes.
I was a yuppie in New York City in the 1980s. And then I dropped out of that and became a ski bum out west, for the 90s. And, for the next almost 20 years, I was, you know, my life was focused around skiing and and rock climbing and outdoor education. I taught up in Alaska, taught mountaineering, and got into ultralight backpacking. So I just completely gave myself over to all that for 20 years.
Absolute outdoors survival in the wilderness.
Well, survival has a funny, I mean, I wouldn't call it survival. Survival.
You weren't a survivalist like with your ammo collection. And a
pointed stick, but
no, but you could survive in the wilderness. I mean, that was a skill that you developed.
I could survive in the wilderness if I had little bags of food that I put together at the, you know, at the grocery store and put it in my backpack. I could certainly survive. Yeah. It's pretty hard to survive off of, you know, eating berries and sorrel leaves and stuff. Right. You'd lose a lot of weight pretty quick. So, I had a handful of events in my youth that I always knew about and I could always talk about. I could sit around the campfire and say, hey, you want to hear an interesting story? And I could tell the story and I could just let her, you know, like, isn't that odd? Isn't that a funny story? And then I never, ever, ever pulled on those threads. You know, I had missing time. I had seen UFOs. I even saw 5 spindly gray aliens out my window when I was living, you know, alone and there they were out there standing in the snow or walking towards the house in the snow. Mm-hmm. I managed to put the lid on all of that and I was denying it. I wasn't going to go there. I had clamped that lid down tight and that all changed in 2006. Now this was sort of leading up to that. There was kind of the pressure was building. I knew I was going to have to look into this. Mm-hmm. And I started reading somewhat compulsively UFO books around 2000. Mm. Somewhere in there. And then, so what happened was I had a couple events where I had saw a bunch of owls camping in the mountains. I saw owls, a number of owls at like kind of like highly charged moments talking about God and things like that. And when I saw those owls in that moment, these were real owls. I'm quite convinced. Short-eared owls are very common owl in that part of the West.
Not screen memory owls as part of an abduction.
I was looking straight at them. They were owl size. They were all of about 15 inches tall. And but they, you know, landed near us,
if I may just say, that appeared in front of you or at you at as you said, very highly charged moments. It was as if they appeared when you were talking about revelations about God or strong emotions and things of this particular sort, as you've written about.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And it happened more than once.
It happened more than once.
Enough. Attention.
And the first few times it happened, there was a voice in my head. I did not say this at the time. I'm saying it now. There was a voice in my head that very clearly said, this has something to do with the UFOs, these owls.
Okay.
And I kind of flipped out for a few years and I did a lot of owl research just on, you know, mythology and totem animals and, oh my God, type in owl mythology into Google and get ready. You'll be, you know, it's a bottomless pit. But so I, and then I started to look into my own UFO experiences, and that meant reaching out to folks. I reached out to Bud Hopkins and Leo Sprinkle and Barbara Lamb and started going to conferences and started talking to people and started asking folks questions. And I also started an online blog, which is kind of, I can't believe I did it. And so the blog was started very early on when I was questioning this stuff. And you can read it. It's right there. You can tell that I'm a mess and I'm emotionally frazzled. And this was, I was not at peace when I started the blog. And I did a lot of podcasting for about 6 years.
I want to tell people your blog.
The blog site is hiddenexperience.blogspot.com.
Yeah.
And you can type in my name, Owls, and it'll come right up too. So, yeah. So Hidden Experience is the name of the site. So as I proceeded down this, you know, kind of two things, I was looking into my own experiences and I would consider this self-therapy in a way. So I was also looking into the owl thing. I would ask everyone, have you had any experiences with owls? I would ask researchers. I would ask people who've had the direct experience. It wasn't 100%, but it was enough that there was a very clear pattern. That people were seeing owls at these, you know, people would, you know, you talk to a UFO researcher and they'd say, have you ever Do owls ever show up in your research? And they would kind of go, well, you know, that, yeah, of course they show up. They show up as the screen memory. Right. And then they have cataloged dozens and maybe hundreds in some cases of owls showing up, you know, in the guise. Well, let's say this would be the typical example. Someone's driving home at night. They see a big owl in the road and they pull right up to it. And the owl looks right at them over the hood of the car. So that's taller than any owl on earth can really truly be. Even a big owl in a small car, they can't look over the hood. So, and then later on, perhaps through hypnosis, the regressionist may ask, you know, well, describe this owl. And the person, the observer would say, well, the owl's got a big bald head and it's got big black eyes. It's skinny. It's wearing a tightly fit uniform. So they're seeing something that's obviously not an owl. But interestingly, that wasn't the core. That wasn't what I was really interested in. I was more interested in the real owls that were showing up at the time of these events. And that's what I began cataloging and archiving and collecting. And that turned into kind of the focus of the blog for a while. And then that turned into a big fat book.
May I just say, first of all, I have your book, The Messengers, right here on my desk. And, I think if I may be so bold as to just state the following. So what you did in your research, your book isn't simply about owls, obviously. It's about owls appearing at certain ways, actual owls, not screen memory owls, not simply to yourself, and you yourself have had some incredible experiences with them, but other people who contributed their own stories, and often in very oddly synchronistic ways connected sometimes to UFO abductions, sometimes to death experiences, sometimes to, in one case, I think an owl helped to prevent the suicide of one of the individuals who wrote to you, and on and on and on, appearing in such a way. And my takeaway of your book then and now is that these are not accidental, and that there is some intelligence, a grander or greater intelligence, perhaps interacting through these owls. This is why you call them the messengers, I think, indicating that there is there's an order, there's a kind of grand intelligent order to our reality, and that these owls, and not simply owls sometimes, but other animals from time to time, can act as to help us interpret our experiences in deep ways if we are willing to do the investigation, do the research. And I guess the other thing that I would just mention is that these owls will often appear to the person in ways that if they use the tools that they are skilled at using, they can decipher, as it were, decipher the riddle. Like you yourself, and I don't want to tell your story, but you know, you wrote about this in your book, and I know you've talked about it many times, your own, what you called your confirmation experience. And I just wanted that people need to know, all right, you had, it was an owl, a coyote, and a shaman, as I'm recalling correctly, connected in important ways with three of your apparent abduction experiences. And you wrote very clearly about them in your book. And your skill, one of your skills, is as a map reader, which I know you're an outstanding map reader.
Well as making maps. So that was part of it too. Yeah.
And what you did, and forgive me for just telling your story, but it just fascinates me.
No, go. I've told it so many times. You're doing great.
You found
this
on Google Earth. You found all of the coordinates of where these occurred. Owl, coyote, shaman. And across several hundred miles, you found to the foot, or maybe even be less than a foot.
I would say the millimeter.
The millimeter, they were in a precisely straight line, those three events. And, you know, that hit, I mean, how did that hit you? How did you react when you had that moment? In fact, didn't you have the flash first in your mind and then you looked on Google Earth?
I came home from a UFO conference. I love to sleep outside. I love to sleep out under the stars. So I I had driven this lonely highway in southern Utah. Now, this is straight out of like, you know, the Roadrunner cartoons kind of terrain. So, and I did, there's this lonely highway there. And I remember driving years before and I said, there's this nice spot. I bet you I could find a spot to sleep there. And it all lined up. And just as the sun had been down and I was tired of driving, I arrived at this spot and I pulled in and I laid my sleeping bag down. And it was a March 10th, 2013. It was a cold night, still winter. And crystal clear skies, a zillion trillion stars. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I looked up on this hillside and I saw this thing that looked, I just said to myself, I'm lying there calm as can be, not a breath of wind, beautiful scene. And I look up on the hillside near me and I say, that looks just like a landed flying saucer. And I was calm and I just kind of said, you know, if this was a landed flying saucer, I'd know. Like, right, you know, I feel like I'm kind of got my psychic mojo kind of dialed up a few notches. And mm-hmm. I'm like, if I would feel it, if this was a flying saucer, I'd know. I felt nothing. I felt absolutely nothing. And I went and rolled over and went back to sleep. A little while later, a coyote woke me up. And I mean, there were two coyotes, but one of them, I do not understand why I didn't see it. It felt like it was sitting next to my head, the how loud it was. And I never saw it. It was so loud. And then, and I looked up and saw that there's the structure. There's that big round thing on the hill. There it is. Rolled over, went back to sleep, woke up a little while later, and there was a bright light behind the bush. And this is like who would be behind that bush right now? You know, and I kind of sat up and I tried to do the thing where you kind of move your head side to side to try to see if there who's in there. And I couldn't. I just like, oh, yeah, there's a bright light behind the bush. And this is very strange, right? This is mm-hmm. like,
sure.
I'm out in the middle of, you know, like I just rolled over and went back to sleep. And again, I saw the big round house. That's what I thought. I said, it looked like you know what it looked like? It looked like that house in the movie Sleeper, the Woody Allen movie Sleeper. There's a round house that shows
from
up
like
on a hill.
71, 72.
Something like that. Yeah.
I actually remember that movie. But, you know, if it's a weirdly futuristic.
Yeah, it's a funny futuristic movie and it's all.
Yeah.
And in like present day, you know, what was kind of, so it's like a Jetson house basically. That's, you know, that was, but
yeah.
I got up the next morning and drove off and got home. It's interesting. I don't remember looking and seeing the house in the morning when I drove off. I may have looked. I simply don't remember. I got home and the first thing I did actually was look on Google Maps. Like literally, I don't think I took my coat off. I looked on Google Maps and tried to figure out what there was a house on this hill. Because if there was, it'd have to be a road and you would see the house. This thing was huge and I pinpointed exactly where the hilltop was, but I couldn't, there was no road, there was no power lines, there was no way to get up there, there was no, certainly no building.
Well, can we do long story short here? Because I want you to get into the rest of this before we hit break.
So I drew a picture of it, did what I did, I put it on my blog. Shortly thereafter, I was standing next to my desk, and I just had a flash, boom, an image in my head of southern Utah, a line in a map, a yellow line with three pushpins in it. And I knew what the one was. That was the one that I had just had the night before.
Right.
And I knew what the other one was on the other end. And that was an event in a tent that certainly plays out like UFO contact. I'm saying that kind of callously now, where I would have had a hard time saying that a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And little by little, I put all three together. And then there came a point when I just kind of zoomed in and clicked on the map thing and brought up that yellow line. And I realized that the three events lined up precisely, exactly, perfectly. And basically, I mean, the only way I can say it is my old life ended and my new life began.
Exactly.
I just was just in that half second. I was like, oh, well, I don't have to worry about wondering anymore.
No, exactly. I mean, I don't know what a statistician or mathematician would say, but clearly the odds against that happening randomly would be astronomically against it. You had and the thing is that these were clues that really only you could have found.
Like, and that took me a while to realize that. Yes, this is.
It was as if it was designed for you.
These set of clues were set in front of me in a way that only. I mean, I had to sleep outside to make this happen.
Right.
Three sites where I slept outside under the stars. I had to know about maps, and so yes, I agree. It was orchestrated specifically for me and me alone.
And similarly. you encountered stories from other individuals who also had clues that seemed to be designed for them, at least not in every single case, but often that was the case. And if not, that was not the case, there were still these synchronicities and things that would happen that just seemed way, way beyond mere chance. Right.
Well, I'm at the point now where I recognize these things, these synchronicities, as a, you know, I mean, they're saying, you know, thread. There's, you know, don't you look away, pay attention to here, pull on this thread, see where it leads.
Well, we've got about 3 minutes before we hit break, and I want to talk about your research for your forthcoming book, Stories from the Messengers. But do you have any ideas or theories? What are we dealing with? What kind of what is this intelligence? You must have thought about this. What's going on?
Well, I mean, I sometimes call it the UFO occupants, you know, and that seems kind of a safe way to say it. But that's a little too simplistic, and I don't try to get locked into that. I'm not afraid to stray away from that, but that's as good a starting point as any.
But that's not enough to say, well, the occupants, they're, let's say, aliens from another planet, some other place. But are they orchestrating our reality in such a synchronistic way that almost seems beyond space and time to me?
Well, then they have who's ever doing it has the mastery of space and time is what it comes down to. Yeah. So then, I mean, it's as if the chessboard, you know, we're on the chessboard and they're looming above us and we have no ability to turn our heads and look up. So we're leading our little lives down here and they're orchestrating events. And so they're not only orchestrating them, you know, in the here and now, they're taking events that happened a decade ago and then something that's going to happen a decade from now are all somehow ready to roll and all set in motion and all the plan is pre-laid. I could think of some examples if you gave me some time, but I mean, in my story alone, I think of, you know, what, you know, things that have stretched over time like that and how on earth that these things would have emerged the way they did.
You once said to me one of the funniest but also insightful things about this that I've heard anywhere, which was, I think you said something like, you know, if dogs were to get together and have a conference on where humans go when we pull out of the driveway for work, that would be like us trying to figure out these other beings.
Well, people go somewhere when they go to work, you know, and it's not a mystery if you're us, you know, we all know what it is, but it's a mystery to the dogs, you know, where they go. Yeah.
Well, it's funny just to think, you know, to imagine dogs trying to figure that out because obviously they can't. And but I agree with you. I think similarly at times I feel utterly outmatched by this phenomenon, the intelligences that are behind it. I just have this feeling, and it's funny because a lot of folks talk about things like disclosure, and you have other people out there talking about having a relationship in a galactic federation and working with these others as equals in some way. And you know, when I read certain some research such as yours and other people too, I think, I just think we're totally outmatched.
I agree. I mean, you know, but at the same time, I mean, the shaman has a relationship with the grand spirit, you know, out there, you know, in their teepee out somewhere in South Dakota. So somehow there's a way to connect with this. I don't think it's going to be around a conference table at a, you know, at the UN. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be much more, I don't want to say spiritual, but be internal, you know? I mean, I think that, you know, maybe something, it's going to be, you know, looking within is going to solve a lot more than waiting for them to show up at the conference table.
Yeah. I think I agree with you. I guess I would say for me, it's a combination of looking within and looking without.
And obviously you have to do both. Yes.
You know, good solid research is always necessary, but there is an element of this phenomenon that, you know, maybe we can call it consciousness, or our conscious connection to this other intelligence, that this is an important element of what is going on. And you're really one of the people at the forefront of looking into these issues. And when we come back, I hope we'll get to talk about some of the more interesting insights that you've gained out of your new research, Stories from the Messengers, and maybe some interesting stories that I think people would like to hear.
Wonderful.
So, well, we're at the top of the hour. I'm Richard Dolan here with Mike Cleland. And by the way, if you want to learn more about Mike, you can go to his blogspot, hiddenexperiences.blogspot.com, is it?
Yep.
Or go to my website, richarddolanpress.com, and there's a lot on Mike Cleland and his book there as well at richarddolanpress.com, as well as authors that I'm publishing, as well as my own books that I publish and so forth. You can go check that out. Mike, great that you're here. We'll be back for another hour. Listeners, stick around. We'll be back in a few minutes. We're back. I'm Richard Dolan here with Mike Cleland. We're talking about, well, his life, his experiences, his theories, his ideas, and his books, The Messengers, and soon to be released by Richard Dolan Press, Stories from the Messengers, a companion to the original book. And by the way, so I've been finally reading this book, which you have a great editor. Do you want to mention?
Suzanne Chancellor. Yes, she's been editing, and we've been, I'm terrible. I'm terrible. I remember when I did the first book there would have been times when you would kind of text me in the middle of the night, like, Mike, what were you thinking? Like, you should never use italics like that. And I would reply back like, Rich, I was an art student, you know, what do I know? So if I know the shape of the letters beautifully, I know all about the shape of the letters, and I'm less concerned about what order they go in sometimes. But
yeah, you're great with fonts and art direction. I have to say.
Yes.
Listen, your writing is actually really good, in my opinion. But it was funny when we were doing the first book, there were just like little things. I mean, I just wanted it to be as polished and perfect as possible, and that's the only reason I was as nitpicky as I was. But now Suzanne is doing that.
She's in charge of
four too, as I recall.
She did some help with, yes. And there was a point when the book was initially published, there was a handful of typos in the handful. And it went through, which is one of the powerful things about online publishing and Kindle, is that you can just clean up the typos and just roll right through. And you don't have to, in essence, publish a second book. You can just upgrade the book that's already been published.
Yeah. But she's an excellent very helpful editor. We're lucky to have her on board. I'll say that.
Yes, I agree.
But what I wanted to say is your new book is, not quite as long as your first book, but it's pretty.
No, it'll
long.
Be about 250 pages or a little less. Like, I bet
it's a respectable length. What I'm saying, I mean, it's a, and I mean, a lot of this book expands on some sort of very, very abbreviated stories that you told in The Messengers.
Well, what it is that in The Messengers, what happened was it's really interesting. I look back and I cannot believe I wrote that book. I read through it and I'm like, holy crap, did I really pull this off? And I read my own words and I'm like, wow, I feel like I was formulating some big ideas in a way, which I'm proud of. And I'm very, very proud of that book. But what broke my heart was I had to take these stories. People have been contacting me. So I've been out there doing stuff on UFOs and owls. And if anyone in the whole world, you're about two mouse clicks away from finding me. If you click, type in UFOs and owls into Google, you're going to find me. And so people are finding me. They're sharing their stories, which I want. I want these stories. But at the same time, these stories, you enter a dialogue with the person who's had these experiences, and it just is so rich and so full. These stories, the account, there's these novels that are floating out there waiting to be written.
And I think this is what you've done. It's an unusual thing that you have done. My observation, it's one thing to go into a UFO story, an abduction story even, and to tell it, but you somehow, I don't know really what prompted you exactly, you somehow made the decision to go way deeper and to extract meaning. It's almost like reading an amazing novel. Like when I read Tolstoy, and I'm not saying Tolstoy,
yeah, I'm great.
But the level of detail that he gets into in life is what attracts me. But similarly, like when you get into, you start unpacking someone's experiences, I really have to say you get into a level of detail that other researchers generally don't do.
And are you talking about the new book or the?
I'm talking about both books. I'm talking about The Messengers, and I'm talking about your current book, which I've read now a good portion of. So yeah, there's a certain level of detail that where you go that I don't think a lot of other researchers go. And I think it does set you apart.
And so the first book would broke my heart because I had to edit out. I just had to edit out so much. You know, I was trying to make a point and the point could be made in a paragraph. So I had to keep it at a paragraph when the story itself would have been 10 pages. I had to just pare that down to a paragraph. It broke my heart.
I mean, there's something to be said for being able to get to the point, but if there really are a complexity of points and you want to do justice to them, and this is, I think, what you're talking about.
And this is the second book. The second book is 17 stories. It'll read like a book of short stories. Some of them are kind of long. Some of them are pretty tidy and short, and you can zip right through them. But what I just wanted to be able to tell these long, more complicated stories. And you've certainly recognized this when people tell these stories, there's kind of an absurd fabric to it. It just kind of goes all over the map. And there's this kind of, I almost want to say chaos involved in the story. It's a story without a conclusion, oftentimes, these people's experiences. And I wanted to try to address those and have the room to sort of stretch out and allow those stories to be told. That could not have happened in the first book. And that's the point of the second book, this companion book, is that now, these longer stories are going to be allowed to be told. These are real people having experiences that are challenging and mystifying and bizarre and sometimes heartwarming and sometimes frightening.
Now, I want to point out, not all of the stories in this book refer back to the original messengers. Some of these are totally new.
Most of them are totally new, and a few of them are, there's a couple of them that start out in the first paragraph. It says, you know, this story was told very abbreviated on page, you know, 303 in the messengers, and now it'll be told in its completeness. And
exactly.
And it's, they, you know, in essence, you know, you're getting the movie trailer and then getting the full movie here.
So can we talk about, there's a couple that I've read and I would love to hear you discuss, and you can toss out any of the others that you want to, as far as I'm concerned. But I was reading earlier today the story of Denise Lynn, who is herself a very well-known person in, I guess you could say, the metaphysical field or consciousness studies. My fiance Tracy knows exactly who Denise Lynn is and thought, wow, she's in Mike's book. And I said, yes, this person is in his book. So, and her story is a particularly interesting one in terms of synchronicities.
I think it's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, would you tell it?
So, I mean, the way I got into this is because she had seen she has a very interesting owl experience. But now Denise Lynn was shot and killed when she was 17 years old. This was in this August of 1967. And she was rushed to the hospital and they revived her. And she had what is now the classic near-death experience where she
described very nicely. And it is absolutely amazing.
Well, this is very easy because she's written a book. So I was just footnoting her book and putting in excerpts where she described it very beautifully. And it was the perfect thing. So, she came to this place that was completely familiar. It was just, she was in an eternal place. There's a handful of NDEs. Now, this is these patterns that show up. There's a handful of near-death experiences that show up in this second book. She feels like she's being lassoed. She's walking across this river, and she knows if she gets across this river, this golden river, it's up to her ankles. She walks across and gets to the other side. She's not coming back. And she's walking across this river just wanting to stay there. And then she's lassoed. She says she's feeling lassoed, and this golden cord pulls her back. And she wakes up in her hospital bed in, like, terrible pain and just wishing she could return. This is the story of the shaman. Some theorists would say that a shaman has to have a near-death experience before they can take on this role.
Right.
There's a second story in 1977 where she's with her husband and they're fishing in Northern California and they're driving home and she sees something, this light out the window and he can't see it from where he is in the truck. And she's saying, turn left here, turn right here. It wants us to stop. It wants us to stop. And he's like, I don't think this is a good idea. And finally they get out of the car and he's kind of doubting her. And he's like, you know, basically, holy crap, what is that? And,
I listened to this and I just want to say, when I was reading this, I thought, you know, if I was driving and a passenger was to state yeah, that object up in the sky is telling us to go this direction or that, I would really wonder about their sanity. I would think, what is wrong with you?
And well, then when you pull off and you see this thing, now this
well,
thing
there you go.
Pulls right up, hovers above the trees. It's like, you know, 40 feet away from them, just hovering above the trees. Now here's, this is so, and exactly. I spoke with Denise. She's a very busy woman. She's one of these like practitioners that's out there making it happen and doing it. And I tried to get a hold of her and I'd send her emails and her daughter would answer. Her daughter's acting as her secretary. And finally I sent an email and basically said, I need 20 minutes. And then the phone rang and she said, first words out of her mouth, this is Denise Lynn. You got 20 minutes. And we talked for, you know, maybe a little over that. And so okay. It was great. I won her over and she gave me permission to write this. And so she was very happy with the way it was written. That makes me feel great. Good. But hovering flying saucer, 20 feet above the trees, she shouts, I guess it's like telepathically in her mind. She feels this wave of love and this homesickness and this compassion. And she says, please help me be of service to others. Help me to help others. She mentally shouts this over and over and over again as tears stream down her face. Mm-hmm. This thing zips away and she wants to follow it. She tells her husband, he's like, no, we're not following that thing. So she is in service to others. She has spent the last decade or quarter of a decade, quarter of a century, the last 25 right. years, like, doing exactly that, being in service to other, writing books, acting as a shaman, writing books on spirituality, you know, just at the forefront of this kind of new age movement that, you know, she's, I don't know what she's published, like 17 books or something like that, 18 books. Now, and this was tough to write. I mean, she writes it too. So I'm saying this is her experience and she's open with this, but.
Well, then the amazing thing that I think even more so, it was 10 years after that in 1987. Can you tell
me about
that?
Well, here's another amazing thing. So the night of so she was shot in the abdomen.
Oh,
shot and
right.
killed. Sorry. Shot in the abdomen. Every doctor said, you're never getting pregnant. Sorry, you can't have kids. Here's the hard news. She's with her husband the night of the UFO event. They get into a big argument. She basically says, you were scared. And he was like, I was not scared. And then later on that night, they end up making love. And 9 months later, and she says right in the moment, she says, I'm pregnant. And he's like, you can't be. She says, I am. Mm-hmm. And 9 months later, their daughter is born. And their daughter is now writing books with her, with her mother. So now this is straight out of, I mean, this is, you know, anyone who's done this type of research knows that there's this overlapping between pregnancy and these issues, unusual pregnancies. 10 years later, yes. After 1977, in 1987, she's reading Whitley Strieber's Communion. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read this aloud here. I think she gets to the point in the book where it says, with a distinct sense of unease and a very improbable but intense memory. Excuse me, Whitley Strieber woke up in the morning after his Christmas night contact event, which we now would call alien abduction. He said he had a distinct sense of unease and a very improbable but intense memory of seeing a barn owl staring at me through the window during that night. And as she's reading this, she looks out the window and there's an owl and a raven sitting on the branch. They're side by side. Actually, it was a crow. Excuse me, an owl and a crow outside her window, 18 inches apart now. Owls and crows, in any birder will tell you, they are sworn enemies. They fight. They harass each other. There they were, calm as can be, staring in full daylight, looking in her window as she's reading the part in Communion where Whitley Strieber writes about his owl experience, which in my opinion is the first. There may be other. I searched hard to try to find any references to owls and UFOs. That's the very first reference in print that I can find. There's people who have stories that took place before then, but they didn't get published until after that book in 87.
Yeah, that was a very interesting little fact that when I read it in your book, I thought, oh, I don't think I realized that was the first time.
Yeah. It may be out there. I simply haven't found it. Other people have pointed me to other stuff, and there's certainly references to deer as a screen memory earlier on, but not owls.
Interesting.
So, and it wasn't too long
but
after
anyway,
that.
She, Well, I just want to just pause here for a second. So she's reading about the barn owl in Whitley's book, looking out her window, and is like 3 feet away. She sees this owl and this crow staring at her. And as I recall, this they stared at her for quite some time. Yes,
they stared at her for a while, and then they which is so this is in the middle. I think she was living in Seattle at the time, in full daylight in the city. So it's not like she's off in the woods somewhere. Who more suited to decipher these clues? Who more suited? Like, she's the perfect person. She's written books on owl totem, on animal totems. So
yeah, exactly.
Now here's the reason I got a hold of her for this story. So I talked to her about this, and she's told me some things, some personal stuff that I won't share, but it was mostly about the emotional side of this, which hit her very hard. So she realized she had to find what is called her true name, her spirit name. And so she went off into the woods to find her spirit name. And she has Native American lineage, and she took this very seriously. So she went alone to the woods. And then this sounds like a UFO abduction report. The woods started getting quiet. They started getting eerily silent, and she sat down to meditate. So she closed her eyes and meditated. And when she opened her eyes, there was an owl on the branch right in front of her, staring at her. Mm-hmm. And it was close enough that she could reach out and touch him. And they locked eyes, and it was probably less than a minute that it blinked and flew off. And she looked at the branch where the owl had landed, and there were three little white feathers on the branch. She picked them up and she held them. And this is where it gets so weird. She heard a voice in her head say, "Put the feathers in your medicine bag." Mm-hmm. And she wasn't sure what to do. And the voice said, "You are your own medicine bag. Put the feathers in your medicine bag." So she ate the three feathers. And she made a little joke. She said, "I don't recommend this because they're really dry." And, you know, and her husband
necessarily the most hygienic thing to do, right?
And so an inner voice said, and I'm reading right from the book now,
yes,
"As you have taken owl feathers into your body, the spirit of the owl has permeated your being and shall always be with you." And she took on the name White Feather as her spirit name. And at that moment, there was a clear knowing that her destiny had shifted with this experience. Now, in the earlier book, in The Messengers, I called the in the conclusion, I kind of summed it up and said, the owl is the totem of the transformational experience. So here it is, clear as clear can be. The woman she's transformed. She knows it. She feels it. This was our discussion. She knew it, and it was powerful for her that she was a different person after eating those three feathers. And this reads like a UFO report, you know? I mean, it has the weird silence. She has the telepathic voice. She has the transformational experience. And there's also, if you read like Jacques Vallée's book, Passport to Begonia, there's all kinds of references to the owls. I mean, fairies coming out of the woods and offering food. And do you know Joshua Cutchin? He wrote a book on called The Trojan Feast, and it was all about food offered by aliens and fairies. And I got a hold of him and said, "What do you make of this?" And he said, "Oh, this is Credo Mutua." And I was like, "What?" And he pointed me to the article, and I was like I almost fell out of my chair when I read this article. Now, Credo Mutua, he's still alive as far as I know. He's a Zulu shaman in Africa, and Denise Lynn had actually met Credo Mutua. Now, Credo Mutua tells this amazing story where he says that someone in the tribe, another shaman, brought this lump of ugly gray meat and said it was from the star people. Mm-hmm. And basically, this is like the flesh of a gray alien, and they ate it. Right. And they went through this, oh my God, it's this trippy, awful thing. They went right to the edge of death, and they almost lost their lives, the three people who ate it, and then they all came out of it being highly, highly psychic. Now, John Mack talks about this, you know, like what it's like to deal with, you know, being an academic and dealing with traditional people, you know, and he says it's very difficult to know where metaphor ends and where an ancient story or a fable begins and where the truth lies, you know? So I'm at the same point, like, I don't know quite what to make of this story. It's beyond fantastic, but it's told plain as day by Credo Mutua and he's in essence telling the same story of Denise Lynn eating the feathers. Right. Except he ate for aliens. So here you have somebody, this is like straight out of The Messengers in a way. This is the whole core, like where the blurring, you get the owl blurs with the alien. So there's two shamans. Both of them have their transformative experience by eating the being of the anointed one. And this is Holy Communion.
You point this out in your book. This is one of the most interesting pieces in this passage, I thought. And I'm sorry. So go on. Yes. It's the eating of the god.
It's the eating of the god. Yes. Which is an ancient ritual. I mean, it's not ancient here. I mean, you can walk right down the street to the Catholic Church and people line up to do it every Sunday morning. They will ritualistically drink the blood of Christ and eat the flesh of Christ. And this sacrament is obviously performed metaphorically with wine and bread, but it is the same tradition that goes right back to Bacchanalia, and even ayahuasca is called the vine of the soul, and they refer to the ayahuasca as this big winding woody vine that they call the cosmic serpent. So when the serpent in the jungle, so when they eat the vine, they call it the serpent, the great serpent. They're eating so this transformative experience comes from eating the sacred animal, the serpent.
So I think with in the case of Denise Lynn, I'm interested in seeing how to connect the owl imagery to that of a UFO or abduction image phenomenon. And in her case, I think what you see is like she has transformative experiences with an owl. She has a transformative experience with a UFO event. After all, it was a UFO event that seemed to be connected with her impossible pregnancy. Is there a more direct connection with the owl and the UFO in her case?
There's no connection with the owl and the UFO, but there's certainly an owl in her life. Yeah. And then there's certainly talk of the single most she entered the realm of the dead and then returned. I mean, that's the ultimate transformation.
Yes,
there,
of course. So in really embodying within her person, she has
and what she does now. Yeah. And she just radiated this over the phone. She just sounded like this, you know, the sweetest grandma, and has this really straight folksy charm about her, and she's doing this work, you know, this shamanistic, modern shamanistic work. Mm. You know, I mean, it's at the forefront of the New Age community. She's publishing books, and she's a past life regressionist. She's working as a psychic. She's working as a healer. She works as a soul coach. This is another pattern that shows up in this book that people have fallen into this. I mean, this is the people who I'm reporting in this book, the 17 stories, the vast majority of them are presently doing work like this, trying to help people.
It's fascinating. Well, look, we're at the bottom of the hour, Mike. I wonder when we come back if we could chat a little bit about Kenneth Arnold, who, of course, is very famous as being the man who coined or helped to coin the phrase flying saucers. And you've got an owl connection with Kenneth Arnold.
Sure.
And, you know, any other thoughts that we may want to come up with in the final segment of this program. I'm Richard Dolan here on KGRA Radio. This is the Richard Dolan Show. I am here with Mike Cleland, author of The Messengers and soon to be Stories of the Messengers. And that's going to be out soon. We're wrapping it up. So stick around a couple of minutes. We'll be back for one more segment. Welcome back. I'm Richard Dolan here for the final segment of the Richard Dolan Show. My guest tonight is Mike Cleland, author, UFO researcher, abduction researcher, owl researcher, and a good friend of mine, and someone, if you're not familiar with his work, this is a good opportunity to become familiar, and you should check him out on his blog site, experiences.blogsite.com, or go to richarddolanpress.com and you can learn about Mike there as well. Mike, we had it. That was a great story about Denise Lynn and the three white feathers. Just incredible. You also wrote about, well, a lot of other people, but Kenneth Arnold. And I think that's something that would catch people by surprise, right?
Well, you know, it's funny because this is interesting. This goes back to Race interviewed Kim Arnold. This is going back probably, probably 2011, maybe 2000. He interviewed Kim Arnold on the show that he had, which I cannot remember the name of it.
Eyewitness Radio.
Eyewitness Radio, yes. And you were with Royce.
That's correct. Absolutely. That's Royce nice. Fitzgerald.
I recorded that. I have that. I still have Royce that. I managed Fitzgerald. To make a copy of it, and I still have it. I think I figured out how to archive that, so it's on my blog. I don't know if I'm cheating and doing that.
No, you absolutely
It was a wonderful
were.
Interview.
Yeah.
And it came out – I mean, I was like Kenneth Arnold's daughter? Like, what are we going to learn from Kenneth Arnold's daughter? And it's a fascinating, fascinating story. And in that story, at the very end – this is right at the beginning of my owl research – she said, oh my gosh, you know, I had a great father. We lived in this wonderful place. We lived out in, you know, on a ranch in Idaho, and I just had a great childhood. My dad was wonderful, and we had a pet owl. And then she said a few more things, and you should have just heard me like sit, bolt upright. What?
Pet owl, you
Kenneth
say?
Arnold had a pet owl? This is like, what? And so I figured out a way to get a hold of this, you know, I got a hold of his daughter, Kim, who was just a few years older than us. You and me, Rich. And so I called her up, just called her up out of the blue. And she's, you know, I was living in Idaho at the time. So I had and she's like, how did you get your number? And I was like, let me ask you some questions. And so we started talking and we ended up getting along really nicely. And so that was sort of the I just had to figure out what was this owl. And she explained that when she was a young, I think she was a teenager, and she was out with her sister, and she was driving home. They found this owl on the side of the road, and it was injured, and it had an injury to its eye. So she took this little baby owl home, and her father, Kenneth Arnold, the guy who saw the UFOs or the chevron-shaped things, nine of them zipping across the sky above Mount Washington, the guy who coined the term UFO, built an owl cage. Oh, excuse me, flying saucer. Thank you. Yeah, sorry. Right. Sorry. He built an owl cage for his daughter, and they had this pet owl in the house. And eventually, as the owl grew, they couldn't handle it. It was just too much of a wild animal, and talons were too sharp, and the claws were too sharp. So they eventually gave this away back to the Boise Zoo. But this was like, okay, so I started pulling on this thread. So, you know, I didn't even, Kenneth Arnold, you know, this like the guy who saw UFO. But, and then I pulled on this thread. I was like, well, he had an owl. I got to see where this is going to lead. Mm-hmm. And he saw more than just one UFO. He saw many UFOs.
And yeah, not a very well-known fact about Kenneth Arnold.
Well, you don't have to dig too deep now that we're living in the age of the internet. And then his daughter and now his granddaughter, who I also spoke with, have sort of taken up the to keep the light, you know, his memory and his importance in the history of the UFO thing. They're both outspoken about their father and their grandfather. But the story of Kenneth Arnold is just fascinating. So I'm going to jump around a little bit. This isn't following the narrative of the story. One thing. So his sighting, and then you just published a book on it, on that sighting.
Yes. 3 Minutes in June by Dr. Bruce McAbee. The best, I think most to the point and up to date, clear analysis of the Kenneth Arnold sighting. And just since you mentioned it, Bruce really did, I think, the single best comprehensive analysis of that sighting that anyone has ever done. And if I just may say, proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that this was, you used the phrase of David Marler, an unambiguous UFO sighting.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what Bruce, I think, proved, frankly, in his analysis of Kenneth Arnold's sighting. We often don't look at the Kenneth Arnold UFO sighting as a great UFO sighting, but in fact, it is a great UFO sighting for a whole bunch of reasons. Arnold was an exceptional witness, and he was able to do very good measurements from the cockpit of his aircraft when he was observing these objects. He had a good location. He had a good ability to do it. And so there's a lot of data to work with. But anyway, go on.
So here's something he did not say in 1947. He talked about it in a 1978 interview. And I'm going to read directly from the quote here. I think that this, and when he says this, he's talking about the June 24th, 1947 sighting. I think that this was the first indication that there was some intelligence somewhere that was able to read my mind. I think other pilots have felt this same way about it. It was a rather frightening experience due to the fact that when you actually felt inside that someone was in your mind and was being controlled or being read in some way by some unknown entities that were apparently making use of it, it didn't make any sense. He's describing exactly what almost every UFO abductee talks about, this voice in their mind, this telepathic communication, and absolutely outright being controlled. And
I don't mean to jump in too many times here. I keep doing it, but
please do.
I in my own very pedestrian manner, in my own very low level UFO sighting that I had almost 20 years ago, I felt exactly that way when I was observing that object with my then 3-year-old son. I felt it was in my head somehow.
This is very common. And so this is, so where does, you know, I make the argument that Kenneth Arnold might be an abductee. Now there's no way to prove it. There's no way to know, but all I can say is, isn't this interesting? Here's these outlying clues. He put all these clues together.
He entertained, at least for the time, unorthodox ideas about what these UFOs were. And you wrote about this as well in your treatment of him.
He saw another UFO that he said reminded him of a jellyfish in the ocean. And he looked down over it. This was in California. And he was flying in his plane again. He looked down into this thing, and it was semi-transparent, like a giant undulating jellyfish, and he could see the trees on the ground through the body of this seemingly organic structure floating in the sky. And I think he kept that quiet, that one quiet, and until years later. Now, this is – so he was seeing UFOs, keeping them quiet. I don't think he wanted to relive the media frenzy that he was at the center of.
Well, also back at that time, I think, you know, you're talking 1940s, 50s, 60s. It was really not, people were not taken seriously if they claimed to see UFOs on multiple occasions.
It just wasn't my understanding. If you had come forward and said, I've seen multiple UFOs, any UFO researcher would take your report and throw it in the wastebasket because statistically that's impossible.
I think that's right.
These are flying saucers coming from another planet. The chances of seeing them are astronomically small. So if you've seen more than one, poof, you're out of the basket,
right,
and into the wastebasket. You know, you're off the desk and into the wastebasket.
It took a long time before researchers, we're talking 1980s. Before researchers began to consider that there would be a single witness that would have multiple sightings.
And that's what Kenneth Arnold was. He was a single witness that had multiple sightings.
Right.
He also saw floating orbs in his house, which is straight out of the UFO literature.
Orb sightings and this idea. Oh, he also had a very strong kind of distrust of the government. He would fit right in among researchers.
He would be like right
in
with the nuttiest of the, you know, new agey folks at a UFO conference. Exactly.
He really would. Yeah. But anyway, the owl connection was, I don't know what to make of that. What do you make of the Kenneth Arnold owl connection?
It's playful. I mean, on one level, it doesn't mean anything, right? So people find owls all the time. I get it all the time. I get it. And honestly, the number of people who've had UFO contact experiences who call and tell me, like, I was driving down the road and found an owl and picked it up and put it in my car, brought it home. That happens, right? People that you go to the places where they rescue animals. People, that's how they got there. People found them and brought them in. They're not all abductees. But for me, this was a this was a thread, right? So I saw this little teeny faint little thread, and all I did was pull on it. It all it did was allowed me to study this one man and his paranormal experiences that were all around him. Now here's a synchronicity that I write about in the conclusion of the book. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the book The Supernatural by Whitley Strieber and Jeffrey Kripal?
Yes, I'm familiar.
Okay,
with
so
it.
In that book, there's a line in that book where Jeff Kripal talks about Kenneth Arnold, and he talks about exactly the issue that what we just talked about, where Arnold had looked through the floating jellyfish UFO and saw the trees below. And this is the quote from The Supernatural that was written by Jeffrey Kripal, who's written some amazing books. He wrote this book, Mutants and Mystics, that I'm convinced was written for me and me alone. He wrote that just so I could have the sheer joy of reading it, as far as I can tell. So Jeff said, this is of Kenneth Arnold. He suggested that these flying objects were in fact groups and masses of living organisms that are as much a part of our atmosphere and space as the life we find in the oceans. And then Jeffrey Kripal said, this is pure Charles Fort. And by the way, was Arnold reading Fort? Now, Charles Fort is an author, that's where we get the term Fortean,
yes,
who wrote these thick, thick, dense books with just one story after another, and it's a pretty hard reading. I've had a hard time trying to wade my way through Charles Fort.
He had a very idiosyncratic way of expressing himself. He was clearly a highly sophisticated, educated man. Spent many, many of his hours in the New York Public Library just hunting down the most obscure, anomalous types of stories from primarily the 19th century. He was doing his research in the 19-teens and perhaps the 20s, I think.
Yeah.
So, he had a somewhat of an older style of writing, and he didn't really lend himself to, grabbing the reader in a kind of an obvious way. He hit things in a very indirect way, I thought.
Yeah, so Jeff asked somewhat rhetorically if Kenneth Arnold had ever read the books of Charles Fort, and I had the answer because I had been doing all this research, and I found this article that took place, I think, in the early 1980s, 1981. Mm-hmm. A researcher went to Arnold's home, and Kenneth Arnold, now an older man, was a little bit fed up with the state of most UFO researchers. And he told this journalist, like, here, let me show you something. And he pulls off the shelf a book of Charles Fort. And he said, I was astounded when I read Fort's books. There were similarities between what I investigated and what Fort had collected. So Jeffrey Kripal asks,
oh, yes,
had Kenneth Arnold read Charles Fort? And the answer was yes. And I found that. And I was so happy. I love Jeff Kripal. So I was so happy I could say, ooh, ooh, ooh. And I sent him this note that said, yes, he did. And I sent him a little clip of the article, and we did a little back and forth email exchange. And he thanked me. And this happened, this email exchange, on August 6th of last year, 2016. That was Charles Fort's birthday, the day we had our little email exchange.
Seriously?
Yes. I mean, this is, and at this point I have, if I don't get these kind of synchronicities, I'm a little bit like, sad, like, oh, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. Something's wrong. So yes, that was a wonderful, playful, perfect little synchronicity. What that told me, like, no proof of it. I can't prove it. What it told me, what I feel inside when I get that is like, yes, I feel like I'm on the right path. I pulled the thread and there was something at the end of that thread.
Well, there's something about this because, I'm sure you've thought about this, but here's Kenneth Arnold. For those people who do the classic nuts and bolts ufology like me, or other people who are interested in just facts and dates and putting the whole story together, Kenneth Arnold's really important. But what we find is that Arnold was a strong Fortean. And when you get into the work of Fort, what that really says is, I mean, Fort is kind of an early version of what you are yourself doing here, Mike. In other words, cataloging very bizarre, anomalous events in our world that don't really make sense in our ordinary paradigm. And it doesn't have to do necessarily with aliens coming from another planet. They have to do with just weirdness that we can't quite explain. And that's what Fort's about. And that's what Fortean means. And we find that Arnold himself was a Fortean. He saw a flying saucer, but he was a Fortean and he had reason to be. And so I just think it brings the whole thing full circle. I agree.
It's
into the Fortean camp here. It's fascinating.
I mean, on some level, Kenneth Arnold is the poster boy for the nuts and bolts experience. And that's on right. another level, he's the poster boy for the parapsychological, mystical, spiritual experience.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It's quite fascinating when we look at it that way. And so in that sense, he really belongs in a book that, I mean, ostensibly is about owls, but is really about synchronicities.
And he was fascinated by synchronicities. He the events of the sighting, he cataloged a lot of synchronicities around the dates, and he got really preoccupied with number synchronicities. This is every UFO abductee I talk to, you can just ask them, like, what's your number? What's the number you see all the time without skipping a beat? They'll say, oh, it's 333. Oh, it's 1234. Oh, it's 111. It's just, this is normal.
Right, but it's always something. It's always a number that just, boom, it keeps appearing for no apparent reason. Exactly. It's fascinating. And in fact, I'm somewhat familiar with this for your original book, The Messengers. I got you in touch with one particular witness who had some very interesting synchronicities in the realm of numbers and related things. And this is something that is absolutely out there. And again, how do we explain these things in a conventional sense? And I wonder, we've got about 5-6 minutes. How do we explain this? How do you explain it? I mean, you talked about this earlier. You said, well, the UFO occupants are somehow able to manipulate our space-time, but I can't help but think it's something more than that. I mean, have you given thought to things like simulation hypothesis or any kind of matrix theories that some people think?
You know, honestly, I don't. You know, my heart and soul tells me, you know, like there's a, like the campfire story, right? So you tell someone a spooky campfire story and it's got, it's kind of like open-ended and or like the shaman tells a fable or Jesus tells a parable, you know, they're not meant to be understood intellectually. Like we could sit down and have a symposium and try to figure out the meaning of Greek mythology, and we'll never come to the conclusion, or we'll never get to an answer. And I'm seeing this the same way. It's like trying to find the pragmatic, rational meaning of a Neil Young song. You know, there is none. It's just, you can feel it. You know, it's like it's got a vibe that's there. And so my sense is that these experiences aren't meant to be deciphered using intellect. They're meant to be deciphered, or they're meant to be felt at a level that where it resonates at a gut level or a heart level.
Yeah, but if they are meant to be felt, then that tells me that there's an intelligence that is doing the meaning. Like they, you know what I mean? Like it's not just some random event.
Oh, I agree it's not some random thing, yes. But I'm at peace with letting the story just float there. I mean, editorialize and try to figure out what's going on and try to, you know, speculate. But I try to keep it at a minimum in this book and the previous book, because the stories themselves have such a power that that I don't want to, in essence, jinx them by over analyzing them. I certainly analyze them right up to the line, and then I feel enough is enough, and I just back off. But I've read about all the theories of the universe and reality as a hyperdimensional holographic simulation. I don't know, that doesn't help me in my day to day life. What helps me is knowing that Denise Lynn went into the woods, meditated, and came out a transformed person. That's what helps me.
I love that. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that approach. On one level, I think we can't help try to analyze what does this mean in terms of our physical reality? What is the intelligence that's managing us like we're characters in a video game or whatever it might be? But maybe it's just a higher wisdom not to be focusing on that all the time and actually just, and understand the message and understand or use that message as a way to deepen our own experience of reality in our lives.
And this is, I mean, I'm coming from the role of an artist. I mean, of someone sort of immersed in the creative process. And actually it was Christopher Knowles who said it. He kind of cornered me at one point and kind of, sent me this message, and he was kind of mad and steamed up, and I could tell. And I didn't, he was kind of like, listen, you're not treating this scientifically. And I got right back to him. I was like, what do I care? I'm not a scientist. who cares? Where's the fool book that says I have to treat this scientifically? Like, no, I'm treating this I like to think of it as I've come to this conclusion. I didn't have it at that point, but I'm like Woody Guthrie, just like walked around the West and met hobos and robbers and criminals and people working in the melon fields, and wrote their music about them, and created this mythos, created this insight into this realm that we can tap into now, like listening to his songs. It's not literal. He's not literally telling the story about what the hobo's day-to-day life was, but he paints a beautiful picture of it. And in a way, that's what I'm trying to do. Like I trust the people who have been telling me these accounts. And part of the reason I trust them is because they mirror the other accounts so cleanly. Like, no one would make this stuff up. And that the fact that multiple people are having the same experiences or such similar experiences tells me something. So I'm more focused on just letting that story ring and be out there and let people make of it what they may.
Well, fair enough. I actually really admire Christopher Knowles and a lot of his writings, but I admire you and your writings, and I think you both have a valid perspective on a way to get into, unpack, and try to understand this crazy phenomenon, which is really maybe one of several keys to helping us understand this crazy existence that we live in. I think for me, understanding the UFO phenomenon, I use that phrase very broadly, I think as you do, is just one possible crowbar with which to pry open some of the really deep esoteric and secret events of our existence. And I think by going down that road, we'll never get to the end point that maybe some of us dream of, where we get all of the answers and all of the wisdom that we seek. But I do feel, I'm sure as you do, that going down that road makes us better people. It makes us more thoughtful, and it does transform us. I'm sure you would agree with that.
I agree. Yes. I mean, it's the same questions. I'm sure people were sitting outside their caves, like eating mastodon meat, like asking, who are we? Why are we here? What does it all mean? And here we are, like talking over Skype, asking those same questions.
Yes, indeed.
It's the owl thing is the tiniest little corner of the UFO. And I mean, most UFO books, and I will mention the owl, it'll be like two sentences in a big thick book.
Yeah.
It shows up. And what I did is I picked the littlest fragmented corner of this huge sprawling subject and just got obsessed and focused on the owl. And I just pulled on that thread and I was not going to let go. And it just got weirder and weirder the more I pulled on it. So what happened was I took the tiniest little corner of the UFO phenomena, and what emerged was this redefinition of reality. I mean, it's my story. I mean, it's me. I mean, I was plagued with these owl sightings. I was asking these owl questions for my own sanity. And what emerged was I now see reality entirely differently.
Yeah. Well, I think that's well said and a good place for us to end this conversation, because we are at the top of the hour. Really glad, Mike, that you came on again. And I have a feeling you'll be on in the future. And I know you've got lots of other interviews and other places where you'll be speaking. Are you going anywhere in particular in the public?
I got nothing. Nothing. My plate is empty.
I got nothing.
I finished this book.
We got to get you out there, but your book will be done. We're home stretching it, and I think within the month, my prediction is that this book will be in print. That's our goal, is it not?
I just knocked on the table. Yes, that's my goal.
Okay, knock on wood. Okay, good. Well, listeners, listen for the sequel of The Messengers, which is Stories from the Messengers. Subtitle will be finalized at some point soon, but it's all about owls, synchronicities, and abductions, and we'll see what when it comes out, but it should be in November of 2022. 2017, and I'm looking forward to seeing it out. I know you are. Mike, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for being on tonight.
It was my pleasure.
My pleasure as well. And with that, it is time to say goodnight. Thanks to my producer, Race Hobbs, the good people in the chat room, and to you on the other end of the connection. I'm Richard Dolan. Looking forward to the next time. Now stay tuned for 3 hours of Fade to Black featuring Jimmy Church. And remember, while we learn and grow and search for the truth in all matters, let's be kind to each other. Good night.